Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Recent additions to the gallery's collection have sparked new discussions and new ways of thinking about fine art. Speaking at the second annual John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art, held on March 23, 2018, at the National Gallery of Art, Judith Brody looks at some examples, including works by Winsor McCay, Saul Steinberg, and the Gorilla Girls, and considers how they both challenge and conform to established thinking, and in what way they reshape the conversation. The John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art is made possible by a grant from the Walton Family Foundation.
I would hazard a guess that most visitors to the National Gallery are unaware that prints and drawings, also referred to as works on paper, make up the greatest percentage of the collection, and that's by a large margin. For every painting, there are something like 25 works on paper in the collection. Ours is not an unusual case. As long as an art museum has a department of prints and drawings, that department's holdings are apt to outnumber those of any other. Factors include the sheer number of prints and drawings to be had, their relative small scale and compactness, making them easier to store, and their relative affordability. Curators who oversee these holdings are handed an opportunity. They can be more inclusive and exploratory in their collecting. They can test the waters. Various recent additions to the gallery's collection, and by recent I mean acquired in the past decade or so, have done exactly that. They have tested the waters. I'll be focusing on three cases: drawings by Winsor McCay, drawings by Saul Steinberg, and posters by the Gorilla Girls. I will try to answer the question of how these works both challenge and conform to museum tradition, and to address how they reshape the conversation. Case number one, drawings by Winsor McCay from 1906 and 1907, which came into the gallery's collection in 2009, subsequent to others donated by the artist's family the previous year. McCay was one of the founding fathers of the modern comic strip and among its most brilliant creators. He has many achievements to his name, but none to my mind that surpasses The Dream of the Rarebit Fiend and Little Nemo in Slumberland, comic strips that ran in U.S. newspapers in the early decades of the 20th century. Dreams are central to both and are typically played out in an alternate universe. At left, Nemo and his companion are launched into outer space, and at right, they visit the North Pole, not quite an alternative universe, but virtually unreachable. Just as a point of explanation, the works that came into the gallery's collection are McCay's original pen and ink drawings for the comic strips, which, when published in the newspaper, were printed with color added, as at the example on the right. There are no continuing characters in McCay's Dream of the Rarebit Fiend, but there is a recurring theme, which is that a man, a woman, or sometimes a child, has a disturbing dream and awakens in a state of confusion, fear, or anger. And that person speculates as to the cause of the dream. Among the perennial culprits is Welsh rarebit, a once popular dish consisting of savory cheese sauce served on toast. This particular sequence begins with the sight of a man wearing a striped dressing gown, reclining on a mat, and smoking a pipe. He expresses relief at finding himself on the planet Mars. At last, he says, I am away from that old Earth and that presidential campaign and can rest here on Mars. But rest he does not get. He watches with trepidation as the Earth draws closer and closer. First, an upside-down Denver comes into view, then Chicago, then New York, and finally Washington, the dome of the Capitol building looming large and ultimately crushing him. Awakened and having fallen to the floor, the man resolves, I'll either have to stop reading politics or eating rarebits. Anxiety hovers over McCay's series, first published in the New York Herald in 1904, 5 years after the publication of Sigmund Freud's interpretation of dreams. McKay's Little Nemo also got its start in the New York Herald a year after Dream of the Rarebit Fiend. In each episode, Nemo has a fantastic and fantastically frightening dream. Here, having awakened from a dream in which he has ascended to the North Pole and where he has endured freezing conditions, we see him being fussed over by his mother. "How do you manage to kick the bedclothes off anyway?" she frets. "No wonder you are sneezing." My first face-to-face encounter with McKay's drawings was at the Hammer Museum in Los Angeles in 2005 at an exhibition called Masters of American Comics. The exhibition featured the work of 15 artists who, the promotional material explained, shaped the development of the American comic strip and comic book during the past century. Masters of American Comics set out to inaugurate a canon to establish a roster of America's greatest cartoon artists. I responded favorably to many of the works on display, but none so favorably and with such enthusiasm as the drawings of Winsor McKay. They struck me as original, not only absorbing for their content, but also striking for their dynamic use of negative and positive space, and for their ingenious structuring of the panels. From a distance, they read as abstract compositions. Up close, they rewarded for their exquisite detail. And on top of all of that, there were the stories, outlandish, magical, humorous, and tinged with anxiety. I saw connections and affinities between McKay's work and that of artists in the National Gallery's collection. For example, the famous 1880 print series, The Glove, by the German symbolist artist Max Klinger. Klinger's series presents a dreamlike sequence of events occasioned by the loss of a woman's glove at a skating rink. The anxiety that permeates Klinger's series is more intensely psychological and disturbing than that of McKay, whose métier, after all, was the comic strip. But both artists were deeply invested in storytelling, fantasy, and dream imagery. I observed an affinity between McKay's drawings and the graphic strength of woodcuts from the 1890s by Swiss artist Félix Vallotton. Now, I'm not about to say that McKay, Klinger, and Vallotton are so closely aligned that I would necessarily exhibit their works together, though there could be circumstances under which that might occur. What I am saying is that the experience of seeing McKay's works opened up my eyes to its unmistakable quality and originality and its relationship to the work of other artists in the collection. I was prompted not only to measure McKay's work against these others, but also to test the waters. While a few eyebrows may have been raised at the suggestion of bringing works by McKay into the collection, what I mostly recall is people's delight in the inventiveness and beauty of the works. Beyond Klinger and Vallotton, I observed the influence of comics in the work of Belgian artist James Ensor. And in a series by Picasso, his Dream in Lie of Franco, done in 1937, in which Picasso adopted a comic strip format and cartoon-like figures. I remembered reading Gertrude Stein's 1933 book, The Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas, in which Stein let it be known that Picasso delighted in the Katzenjammer Kids, which Gertrude and Alice would supply him, passing on their funny supplement from the Sunday newspaper. Of course, most obvious was the impact of comics in the work of post-war artists like Roy Lichtenstein and Ed Ruscha. The next card-carrying cartoonist whose work we acquired was Art Spiegelman. Spiegelman is said to have no use for the art world, which he maintains is just an extension of the fashion world these days. Still, when I contacted him to say that we were acquiring his work, he sounded mighty pleased. In Lead Pipe Sunday, Spiegelman bemoans the passing of Depression-era comics. Legendary characters appear as cast-offs, forsaken on a barren stretch of land. At center right sits Happy Hooligan, his head in his hands and a lightning bolt threatening overhead. Marooned at upper left is the square-jawed Dick Tracy, looking much like an Easter Island totem. Peeking over the horizon line is the head and the blank eyes of little orphan Annie. Popeye is at upper right, and at lower left is Nancy, her face obstructed by the text, but recognizable because of the signature bow in her hair. Face down on the ground, looking despondent, or perhaps just knocked unconscious, is a disembodied head, a lima bean-shaped cyclops that was the invention of Philip Guston, and which is the subject of Guston's painting at Wright. A successful abstract expressionist artist for more than 20 years, Guston changed course in 1966. He went from painting purely abstract works, such as the one at far left, from 1957, to paintings such as the one at center and at far right. When Guston first unveiled these figurative works, which was in 1970 at the Marlborough Gallery in New York, they so smacked of comics that several of his fellow artists walked out in disgust. Guston had embraced what they believed to be a low and vulgar form, one that was outright cartoonish. The critic Hilton Kramer was incensed, famously calling the work primitive and labeling Guston a mandarin pretending to be a stumblebum. Trafficking in comics can elicit very strong reactions. Following Spiegelman's Lead Pipe Sunday, drawings by George Harriman, a highly original artist and creator of Crazy Cat, came into the collection, drawings that I solicited from Gary Trudeau of Doonesbury fame. Trudeau donated this and another by Harriman, as well as ones by Walt Kelly, the creator of Pogo, plus one of Trudeau's own drawings for Doonesbury. More than 175 underground comic books, including seminal issues such as these of Zap, with covers by Robert Crumb, came into the collection in 2014 as the gift of William and Abigail Gertz, two distinguished scholars of American art whose taste runs normally to 19th century American still lifes. I ask myself what Andrew W. Mellon, the founder of the National Gallery, and David Finley, the gallery's first director, would think of all of this. Not to put too fine a point on it, but I fear they may be rolling over in their graves. Among the paintings and sculptures that Mellon donated in 1937, the year the gallery was inaugurated, were Raphael's Alba Madonna, Van Eyck's Annunciation, and Botticelli's The Adoration of the Magi. I imagine Mellon and Finley would have a lot to say about our acquiring Zap comics, or perhaps they might be just left speechless. Case number two, Saul Steinberg. Saul Steinberg was born in a small town in Romania shortly before the outbreak of World War I to parents of Russian Jewish descent. At age 19, he went to Milan to study architecture and there became deeply engaged in drawing, contributing cartoons to Italian newspapers specializing in humor and satire. Racial laws imposed in 1938 by Mussolini, however, which included barring Jews from skilled professions, put a halt to that. Steinberg remained in Italy long enough to earn his architectural degree, but all the while he looked for refuge elsewhere. Finally, in the summer of 1942, he arrived in Manhattan, and about 6 months later, he became a U.S. citizen. Steinberg's work was exhibited at the Museum of Modern Art 4 years afterwards. The Whitney Museum of American Art mounted a retrospective of his work in 1978. Over the course of 6 decades, he made more than 1,200 works for the New Yorker magazine alone. All in all, Steinberg gained quick and wide acceptance in his adopted country. But despite that, he continued to maintain the vantage point of an outsider. In 2016, the National Gallery received a gift of 34 drawings and a sketchbook from the Saul Steinberg Foundation, about half of which are currently on view in an installation in this building. Spanning the years 1945 to 1984, the display includes a wide range of subjects and types, from World War II air raids to New York hipsters, from exquisite collages to bogus documents embellished with fake signatures and seals. Steinberg's vantage point as an outsider gave him insight when it came to the observation of others. Each guest at this chic cocktail party is represented in a different style. He used a pointillist technique to depict the woman at right wearing black-rimmed glasses. He employed a stippling method for the seated woman at lower left, right here, a figure so insubstantial as to be an existential crisis. The man in the checkered suit seated on the couch is the critic Harold Rosenberg, a vocal supporter of abstract expressionism. Steinberg had an active social life and would have been a regular at cocktail parties such as this one. I imagine him standing at a distance, sizing up the group. While Steinberg was friendly with such abex artists as Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning, he was not apt to hang out with them at the Cedar Tavern. He didn't comfortably fit in that crowd, nor was his art like theirs. A friend of his remarked that, quote, he was somehow not treated as the great artist he was. People would say, yes, he's fantastic, but then they'd call him a cartoonist, and the word cartoonist had a bad edge to it. In Steinberg's self-portrait, done at age 70, there are aspects that ring true and others that do not. For example, the studio in which he pictures himself bears no resemblance to any that he ever occupied. On the wall behind him is an array of images, great works of art that inspired him, such as a painting by Mondrian, composition with blue and yellow, incidentally in the collection of the Hirshhorn Museum. I have to say that for one who claimed that art with a capital A made him suspicious, Steinberg surely surrounded himself with a good deal of art with a capital A in this drawing. Highlighted at left is a painting by Van Gogh, seen here as it actually appears. To the right of Steinberg's head is a painting by the 19th century artist Jean-François Millet in the collection of the Musée d'Orsay. A painting by Goya at right is from the Prado. And another painting is The Sower, again by Millet. Which brings me to a painting by Norman Rockwell, his triple self-portrait. What I have come to think is that Steinberg, in his self-portrait, took inspiration from this painting by Rockwell, another artist who did covers for magazines, most famously the Saturday Evening Post, and who, like Steinberg, was an immensely successful commercial artist. Tacked to the upper right of Rockwell's painting are works placed there as inspiration. A self-portrait from 1498 by Albrecht Dürer, a self-portrait by Rembrandt, an unidentified painting by Picasso, and at the bottom, a self-portrait of Van Gogh at his easel. Though Steinberg's work was exhibited at museums during his lifetime, he generally had an uneasy relationship with museums, a fate shared by Norman Rockwell. Was Steinberg, in his self-portrait drawing, perhaps channeling Rockwell, another artist with outsider status in the art world? Curiously, in the self-portrait, Steinberg does not depict himself with the mustache that in fact he had the year the drawing was made. He also seems never to have smoked a pipe, whereas the clean-shaven Rockwell is almost invariably pictured smoking or holding one. I have lately come to think that fans of Steinberg should stop defending against his cartoonist roots and outsider status. By his own admission, Steinberg was an outsider when it came to the museum world. Quote, I don't quite belong in the art, cartoon, or magazine world, he said, so the art world doesn't quite know how to place me. But an outsider, or better yet, an outlier, the term used by my colleague Lynn Cook, is by definition someone beyond the statistical norm. Recognizing someone as an outlier is not a judgment of quality. Steinberg was an enormously successful commercial artist, and in relation to mainstream art world, commercial artists are outliers, fringe dwellers, as Lynn Cook calls them. But as demonstrated, there is a fitting context for cartoonists and other outliers in the Fine Art Museum. Case number three, the Gorilla Girls is a group of feminist activist artists who keep their identities unknown. Since the time they became active, which was in 1985, there have been some 55 members of the group, some of them members for weeks, others for decades. On their website, the Gorilla Girls state, "Our anonymity keeps the focus on the issues and away from who we might be. We wear gorilla masks in public and use facts, humor, and outrageous visuals to expose gender and ethnic bias, as well as corruption in politics, art, film, and pop culture. We undermine the idea of mainstream narrative by revealing the understory, the subtext, the overlooked, and the downright unfair." In 2007, the National Gallery acquired the Gorilla Girls' Most Wanted portfolio, comprising 30 illustrious posters from 1985 to 2006, one being, "Do Women Have to Be Naked to Get into the Met Museum?" Produced in 1989 and among the Gorilla Girls' best-known works, the poster targets the Metropolitan Museum of Art, pointing to its underrepresentation of women artists. While less than 5% of the artists in the modern art sections are women, the poster decries, 85% of the nudes on view are female. The notorious poster is based on Ang's famous odalisque at the Louvre. The Gorilla Girls ran the poster as an ad on New York City buses until the bus company canceled the contract, arguing that the protruding fan and the hand of the nude was too suggestive. Here are two more zingers from the Gorilla Girls portfolio. And possibly my all-time favorite, first published in 1988, The Advantages of Being a Woman Artist, among them working without the pressure of success, knowing your career might pick up after you're 80, seeing your ideas live on in the work of others, and not having to undergo the embarrassment of being called a genius. Since acquiring the Gorilla Girls portfolio, individual works have been shown in three National Gallery exhibitions, and more will be shown in an exhibition this fall. I would argue that the transgressive nature of the posters is all the more potent in a museum such as this one, which was founded on highly conservative principles of taste. Exhibited at a museum devoted solely to modern and contemporary art, the works would still pack considerable punch, but not to the degree that they do here. And for that reason alone, I would say they are a perfect fit for the National Gallery, where they share physical and ideological space with historical works of art, and thus where their effect is maximized. In conclusion, if I were to be asked if the works of Winsor McCay, Saul Steinberg, and the Gorilla Girls dramatically changed the conversation, I would say no. Asked if they reshape it, I would answer yes. Asked if Winsor McCay, Saul Steinberg, and the Gorilla Girls and others of their ilk should be represented in the National Gallery's collection, with all due respect to Andrew W. Mellon and David Finley, my emphatic response would be, you bet. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.